I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. More than 40 years ago, two young sisters disappeared from a mall in suburban Washington, D.C. It was a story that dominated the news at the time and was covered by a young reporter, Mark Bowden. The girls were never found. The case went cold until a few years ago when a detective stumbled on a piece of evidence. Our guest Mark Bowden picks up this story in his new book, The Last Stone. It's based in large part on recordings that detectives made with Lloyd Welch, a pathological liar who was serving time in a Delaware prison for child molestation. The book traces how detectives use flattery, empathy, confrontation, friendship, and lying to pick apart Welch's denials and constantly changing stories, revealing a horrifying crime. It's also about the psychological cost of this kind of investigative work on police interrogators. Welch pleaded guilty to two counts of felony murder in September 2017. I should add that Mark Bowden met with Lloyd Welch a year ago in prison to find out why he kept talking with detectives. Mark Bowden joins us once again on Radio Times. He's a journalist, author of 13 books, including Black Hawk Down. He was a reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer for some 20 years, in fact, covered crime in this city, and he now writes for The Atlantic and Esquire. Mark Bowden, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
Let's go back to 1975. These two sisters, Sheila and Catherine Lyon, age 12 and 10, are at a mall together outside of Washington, D.C., and they disappear.
Yep, they just didn't come home. You know, their parents, John and Mary, expected them for dinner and sat down with their two sons and two empty chairs, and they were a little annoyed. You know, why are the girls not home? Why didn't they call? And then after dinner, they still weren't home. They started calling friends. They got in the car and started driving around the neighborhood looking for them and then called the police.
And as a parent, as I know you are, I think parents or almost anyone listening to us, the thought that you did not know where your child was is absolutely terrifying.
It is. It's just terrifying. And you feel, I don't know, like you did something wrong, but they didn't. And, of course, it was a great deal of confusion. And as time went by, multiple counties there in the Washington area mobilized to try to find these girls. And I was just a young reporter who was thrown into the story.
Well, as you say, John Lyon had a radio show. He went on his show the next day and even talked about it, thinking, well, maybe they spent the night at a friend's house, but we just didn't know about it.
Right. He said they probably told us.
And we forgot.
We probably forgot. You know, just you don't want to believe the worst. But as time went by, it became apparent that something terrible had happened.
You, as you said, you were a young reporter at the time, interviewed the parents, and I've never had to do that as a reporter talking to parents who don't know where their children are. What do you ask them? What did you ask them?
Stupid questions.
John, how does it feel kind of questions?
Well, yeah. And, you know, what's going on and what have you heard and what are you doing? Or, John and Mary, John particularly because he was a disc jockey, he was in the media himself, recognized the value in getting, you know, publicity about the missing girls. And in the first days, they opened up their house to all of the reporters who were there to cover the case. And they would hand out soft drinks and beers. And Mary was, I think, on tranquilizers, but she was holding her own. And John was just, I think, trying to do his best. And he would generously try to answer any questions that anyone had. But they were clearly distraught and desperate.
You're right. I could not witness their pain dispassionately.
You know, and I think that today it would be more natural. But I was a kid, and I had just gotten my job as a newspaper reporter, and this was a huge story. So part of me, most of me, was just, like, real excited. I was covering this big story, writing these front-page stories. And I think getting to know the Lyons and the detectives who were so frustrated – they became more than subjects of a story to me. I mean, I could not help but feel their frustration and their fear and ultimately the tragedy of the thing.
I mean, you call this a regional trauma, how it affected, I guess, the Washington-Baltimore area, maybe even beyond, the thought of children disappearing from a mall.
Yeah, and, you know, in those days, this is pre-internet, pre-cable TV, so it was primarily a regional phenomenon. But, all of us, I'd grown up in a suburb where my mother would say to my brothers and sisters and I, after breakfast, get lost. You know, don't come back until lunchtime. And we had free run of our community, basically, and no one feared. And I think that was the prevailing ethos, really, for raising children. And this put a chill on that. I think that this, and over time, more and more attention being focused on cases like these. Nowadays, I mean, a parent who leaves a child untended somewhere might end
up... For five minutes.
They could be answering questions from the police. Right. But that was a different era, and this was a real blow.
Is haunted, is that too strong a word to say that this case haunted you for decades?
Well, that's the word that I used. You know, you never forget it. I mean, you wonder all the time about what happened and who would have done this. You know, I had children of my own. And I think when you've been acquainted with someone who's had a tragedy like this in their life, I mean, you do worry more. I mean, you are just more aware of, even as infinitesimal as the chances are, right, your children are so precious to you, you can't help but be haunted by your experience with a situation where things went horribly wrong.
I mean, I guess we shouldn't be surprised that there were sightings of these two girls. This often happens, sometimes mistaken, sometimes maybe more nefarious than that. Also, extortion attempts, which to me is just disgusting.
I know. It's appalling. I mean, people, such a level of cruelty to try to exploit the situation, calling up John and Mary and saying, you know, we'll return your girls if you leave $10,000 in a bag outside of a store or something. And it was just that what they went through, even beyond the tragedy of losing their two daughters, was just, I mean, things that I would never have imagined happened.
The detectives, though, and there were a number of them, didn't give up. In fact, one in particular, a guy named Chris
Homrock.
Homrock.
Yeah.
Stumbles, maybe that's too dramatic a word, but he takes a look at a witness statement of someone who was in the mall. A guy named Lloyd Welch was in the mall at the time, and he went to the police and told them what?
He told them a story. He said he had seen the girls being led out of the mall by a man. And he gave the police a detailed description of the man, of the car he was driving. He made up a very detailed story. And then when they gave him a lie detector test and they started probing, he flunked the lie test. And he also ultimately admitted that he had made up much of what he had told them. So they just dismissed him. He was 18 years old. He was high. There was a reward for information leading to finding the girls. So they just assumed this was a knucklehead who came in here and wasted our time. And somebody filled out the report but just wrote lied on the top of it. And it went in the file, and no one paid any attention to it for about 40 years.
So what was it about Chris Hamrock? He took a second look at this, and what did he say?
Well, Chris had, working with the cold case unit at Montgomery County Police in Maryland, had a suspect, a guy named Ray Molesky. And Chris was just determined that Ray Molesky was the person who kidnapped the girls. There were all kinds of circumstantial evidence pointing to him. One of the things that was true about Molesky was that he walked with a limp. So he sees this report, which he can't believe because he said he knew that case file inside and out. He sees it for the first time back in like 2015, and this kid, Lloyd Welch, 18 years old, describes the person leading the girls from the mall as walking with a limp. And he thinks, aha, now I have a witness. So they start looking for Lloyd Welch.
And they find him in a prison in Delaware.
Yes, and in prison for child molestation, which rings a bell. Yep. And so immediately they begin to wonder, you know, was Lloyd Welch involved with Ray Molesky in some way? We need to find that out. But most importantly, they went to him, most importantly, to get him to confirm that the man he saw was Ray Molesky.
But interestingly, when they go to this prison in Smyrna, right?
Smyrna, Delaware.
Yeah. Lloyd says to them, I know why you're here.
Right. And they had been very careful not to tell. When they were looking for him, they called family members and they'd said, well, I'm calling from the Montgomery County Police, and they wouldn't say why, trying to find Lloyd. And yet, and they had wanted to use that. They didn't want him to know, you know, what had prompted their visit to him, because that would tip him off and he would, I don't know, it would influence, you know,
sure,
the way he answered questions. Sure. And so that they, Dave Davis, the detective who first encountered him in the hallway, was confronted with, I know why you're here. You're here because of those two little girls. And he was just completely thrown off. I mean, his whole approach to Lloyd Welsh before he even sat down with him was like out the window.
Well, and the book in many ways is about the interrogation, these detectives interrogating Lloyd Welsh. And it's almost disorienting. He's such a liar.
Yeah.
That as the reader, I'm going down sort of one path and I'm listening to him describe something. And then next thing you know, he flips the whole thing on its head.
Yeah. And, you know, without hesitation or the least bit of shame, he will completely drop the story he just told you and tell you a different story as if he had never told the earlier right. one. But, you know, this is what really fascinated me, frankly, about this story. I would never, 40 years later, have decided I want to go back and, you know, write about the Lyon sisters. But when I was interested enough when I heard that they had named a suspect to go down and meet the police and ask them about what yeah. they knew and how they found this guy. And then they explained to me that they had pinned the crime on him by getting him to confess, basically. And that was just like, how do you get someone to confess who's already in jail, you know, who's going to be getting out in like 2 years? What is going to make him admit that he did this terrible thing other than a crisis of conscience, you know, where he decides to come clean, which turns out not to have been the case at all. And so they told me that they basically had to work on him through this extended interrogation that went on for almost 2 years and get him to eventually corner him. And I said, well, do you have records of those conversations? I said, we have video of all of it. And I knew right then I can do this. You know, this is for a number of reasons I knew that I could do this story.
And we're almost up in a break here, but the thing that they wanted to do was to keep him talking, knowing that he was lying as much as he was saying anything, but just right. to keep him talking.
Right. As Dave told me, that people who lie about the big things, but they fill in the lies with the truth. And I wasn't sure what he meant right. when he told me that. But then as I wrote this book, I came to realize that's exactly how they did it.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mark Bowden, our guest on Radio Times. And he's got a new book we're talking about called The Last Stone. And it's about a, frankly, notorious double murder of two young sisters back in 1975. They were kidnapped from a Washington, D.C. shopping mall. He covered the murders as a young reporter and now has revisited this whole story based on these video recordings that police detectives did with a guy who's sitting, as we speak, in a prison in Smyrna, Delaware. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Mark Bowden about his newest book. I believe it's his 13th book, and it's called The Last Stone. You mentioned a detective named Dave Davis, and he was so important to this story as a, what, the kind of lead interrogator?
Yeah, he had a reputation in the Montgomery County, Maryland police for being their best interviewer or interrogator. And Dave accomplishes this because he's just a really genuinely charming, friendly guy and doesn't come off, in fact, deliberately doesn't come off to people as a cop. And people warm up to him and he's very good. And one of the other detectives said, Dave is very genuine, even when he's not being genuine.
Which sort of like the guy he was interrogating, Lloyd Welsh?
Yeah, it was a good match for him because Dave was every bit as capable of dissembling and misleading Lloyd as Lloyd was him. So this was really a contest between not just Dave, but Katie Leggett and Mark Janney, the three prime detectives, over this, as I said, almost 2 years, developed relationships with Lloyd. And each played different roles, and it went beyond just good cop, bad cop. It was much more subtle than that.
Well, Katie Leggett administered the polygraph. But what I thought was so interesting was all the lead up, the conversation that she has with Lloyd Welch as she's essentially setting up the polygraph test, how revealing that was. And I always thought with polygraphs, you just, you know, you look at the readout and that tells you whether someone may or may not be telling the truth. But there's so much more to it than that.
Well, I think initially all Katie was trying to do is put him at ease. People are a little nervous taking the test. And so she wanted him to feel relaxed and she wanted him to feel at ease. So what she does is talks about herself and encourages him to talk about himself. And they developed, because she's an attractive woman and Lloyd's been in prison for a long time, and he liked talking to her. And so she played on that and very deliberately played up herself as being kind of the dumb blonde who couldn't figure out how to make the polygraph work and asking for his help. And she knew how to flatter a man.
And it sort of worked, I guess.
Well, I mean, he did genuinely, he came to really like her. And even though they butted heads from time to time, he would always apologize because he seemed to really kind of care about kind of keeping that relationship with Katie.
Well, and it's interesting to look at Lloyd Welch, whether he is a pathological serial liar. So is he playing them as much as they are, in a sense, playing him? Is he just likes the attention, so he wants them coming back for more?
I think that's all true. I think he's playing them. But again, you know, and you see these things in movies or in plays, you know, everything is scripted. Everybody knows exactly what they're doing. I think that in real life, Lloyd was not quite sure how much they knew. So he had to keep talking to them in order to find out what they knew, in order to protect himself. They didn't know when they first met Lloyd what he knew, how involved he was. They knew he was lying to them. They had to try to figure out how to tell the difference between the lies and the truth and how to encourage him to tell them more.
Did he know that they knew that he was lying?
At first, no. I mean, it's the most fascinating thing to me is that he had forgotten about, or he thought maybe they weren't aware of the statement he had made back in 1975. So when
at the mall, right?
At the mall, when he was 18 years old, he went and he told that lie, told that, made up that story. And so when they meet him, 40 years later, they ask him about that day, and he tells them a completely different story. And Dave eventually says, well, you know, here's a copy of the statement you made in 1975, which completely contradicts what he's just told them. And what does Lloyd do? He just shifts gears and starts on a third story.
Wow.
And so they got a taste. And frankly, right at the beginning, that capacity of Lloyd's to so swiftly change his story and so eagerly change his story made them suspicious of him.
You mentioned Katie, and she says, we knew we were dealing with a monster, but we had to entertain him in a fashion that was the best approach with him. We had to keep him talking, had to keep him on our, quote, team. We had to endure the friendship and go through the crap to get as many of the answers as we could.
Right.
There is a kind of price that these interrogators play by, in a sense, pretending to be his friend or his confidant to flatter him, to make him feel good about himself.
Yeah. I mean, these are police. I mean, they're trained and their profession is to arrest people who've committed crimes. And yet, in this situation, they are basically going along with Lloyd's efforts to explain, well, what I did was not really so bad, or he's talking about the child molestation case that landed him in prison for 30 years. And they're kind of sympathizing with him. Oh, gee, that really wasn't such a terrible thing that you did. And
this is a young girl he molested.
Yeah, I mean, Dave had two little girls who were right about the same age as Sheila and Kate Lyon. So he's appalled by this person, but he has to pretend that he's his friend and that he can see things his way. And this takes a toll.
Yeah. And maybe it's Katie or someone does go to a therapist.
Katie started seeing a therapist about it. Yeah.
Right. Just to kind of deal, I guess, with that kind of.
You know, I think that it's one thing to know that people like Lloyd Welch exist and are out there. It's another thing to sit down with them, you know, day in and day out and kind of enter into their mindset and into their world without, all the while suppressing your own inclination to say, that's horrible. You know, how could you think that way? They don't ever say things like that. And I think that after a while, it does begin to make you disorient you. And I think she has children of her own. And so she's very concerned, much more concerned about them. And, you know, these kinds of things ate at her.
Do you think there are parallels between being a detective interrogator and a journalist interviewing people?
Very much so. I mean, I think one of the reasons that I've long been interested in interrogation is that I spend my life, as you do, Marty, interviewing people. Right. And there are skills that you develop. Listening is the big one. And so I'm fascinated by people who do this in other professions. And I think, you know, it's hard enough for me sometimes interviewing someone who's trying to be helpful, trying to get them to tell me what I need for the story that I'm writing. Whereas the detectives are dealing with people who are hostile,
yep,
who have every reason in the world not to tell them anything. And that level of challenge is one that I find fascinating and, frankly, admire people who manage to get over it.
Well, you reminded me before we going on the air when you were at the Philadelphia Inquirer. For some 20 years, you were in many ways a crime reporter there. So sort of had a running knowledge or understanding about this kind of cat and mouse game that detectives often play with criminals.
Right. I think, you know, when you start out as a reporter, at least in the era that I did, all of us pretty much started out covering cops and crime. My first job was to come into the newsroom at 4 o'clock in the morning and call every police barracks in the state and ask them if anything happened overnight.
Right.
And if anything had, I would have to go and talk to the police. And so you develop relationships with police from a very early age as a reporter. And then, you know, over time, you know, at the Philadelphia Inquirer, it was kind of a freewheeling atmosphere, and we would compete to get the best stories. And a good crime story would always get great play in the newspaper. So we were always on the lookout, going through the police blotter, looking for that little story that we could maybe make into something, you know, compelling.
That's Mark Bowden, our guest on Radio Times today. And again, he's got a new book. It's his 13th, and it's called The Last Stone. And we are talking about this case that has haunted him, frankly, haunted a number of detectives going back to 1975, the disappearance and, in the end, double murder of two young sisters. They were kidnapped from a Washington, D.C. mall. Mark Bowden covered this murder as a young reporter and picks up the case based on some interviews that police detectives did with a criminal who was sitting in a Delaware jail, prison, I should say. We don't have time to go into Lloyd Welsh's family history, but suffice it to say, it is horrifying,
yeah,
including abuse and incest and violence. And he was even, sort of, as you describe him, even an outcast within his own family.
Right. Yeah. I mean, one of the reviewers, I think, aptly called the family a gothic subplot in this book. It's just a horrible family where predation of children and women was commonplace. Siblings preyed on each other, on cousins. Uncles preyed on nephews and nieces. Fathers on children. Lloyd Welsh was raped by his father when he was 9 years old multiple times. And this culture of this family kind of normalized what most people in our society would regard as criminal, really horrible behavior. So even in that context, Lloyd Welsh was regarded as aberrant and dangerous and was basically kicked out of the family very early on.
Did you ever interview members of his family?
I did, yeah. I interviewed several who played key roles in this story. I think, you know, one of them was Thomas Welsh Jr., Teddy, who has his own incredible story of being molested as a child and then attacking his father and then being taken out of his home and being adopted at age 13 by a middle-aged pederast named Leonard Crysell, who picked him up hitchhiking and basically took him in as his, concubine for a decade or more and continued a relationship with Teddy on through into adulthood, and eventually is now in prison, Chrysell is, for molesting Teddy's children.
Oh, gosh. Which, I mean, it's hard to know what to say. I mean, on the one hand, perhaps we shouldn't be surprised when you see this level of dysfunction and sort of horrifying violence that it gets repeated on children and, in the case, grandchildren as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, families have their own cultures. This
they
just
do.
Happens to be a very aberrant, disturbing family, and the kind of experiences that Lloyd had were commonplace. Mm-hmm. And so really when you know that and you see when he's out in the real world and he steals two little girls, it's almost like, how could this not happen?
Mm. As you describe, this interrogation went on for almost 2 years. They met multiple times with Lloyd Welch. But Dave Davis, one of the reporters or one of the investigators, looks at this house and begins to connect some of the dots.
Right. You could never believe anything Lloyd told you, any of the stories that he told. But after a while, he had told so many different variations of the same story that there were certain particulars. And these are the little truths that Dave said were used to build the lies. But certain particulars, and one of the particulars that surfaced in every story was that the girls were being kept in a basement that was separated from the house above and could only be entered by walking around to the backyard and entering through a door from the backyard. And so he went out, one day trying to check up on Lloyd's latest version of events and rapidly concluded that he'd made it up because it couldn't be true. Mm-hmm. And as he's leaving, he spots this house, which he recognizes. This was the house that was owned by Lloyd's parents back in 1975. So he decides to take a look, and he knocks on the door, and the woman tells him that the only way to get to the basement is by walking around the house and going to the backyard. Mm. Now, Lloyd had never placed this house at his parents' place. He'd, remember, been kicked out by his parents, years earlier, and he had a very estranged relationship. But Dave walks around to the backyard, opens the door to this dungeon-like basement, recognizes the description of the room, which has come up again and again and again, and realizes this is the place where these girls were held.
So is it just this extensive interrogation and being, I guess, a skilled but not perfect interrogator, having just enough information and then a kind of serendipity that to see this house and begin to put all this stuff together?
Yeah. I mean, I think these little nubs of fact which kept surfacing in all these stories, when you knew Lloyd, you realize that he was always trying to deflect blame from himself. So he would sort of tell you the truth, but he would always place himself off center. Well, this was similar. I mean, he had named the place where the girls were kept, and it was miles away, and he had described it, but he had put it off center. And so Dave realized, wait a minute, and if you know how Lloyd's mind works, he began to realize this makes sense, and it made even more sense to him, because Lloyd had never said this was the place.
Did they ever threaten Lloyd? I'm thinking you wrote about interrogation under the Bush administration. I'm thinking about, how they were able to, it took decades, but certainly almost 2 years of interrogation to try to figure out this case. Did they ever threaten him? Did they ever, waterboard him? Did they ever withhold food or, put him in a freezing cold room?
No, they didn't physically do anything, but they did coerce him, and they did threaten him. He lives in a prison. Child molesters are often attacked in prisons. He had, over the years, kind of developed a cover story for why he was in jail. So they let him know they were going to expose him in a press conference. This is before they knew everything they needed to know about him. We're going to let people know that you're a suspect in this case, which endangered him so much so that they had to put him in isolation in the prison, which ruined, the little pattern of life he had carved out for himself. So, and of course, they're always threatening him with being charged with murder in this case, and he's insisting that he didn't do it. So he was, without question, coerced.
Yeah. He did plead guilty to two counts of felony murder. This was September 2017, so almost 2 years ago.
Right. Some of the methods used crossed the line in subtle ways, certainly not to the degree of waterboarding someone, but enough so that the Maryland prosecutors were worried that a good defense lawyer could get all of Lloyd's statements thrown out. And really all they had to go on, for the most part, were Lloyd's own comments about what he did and his involvement. And if they threw them out, they wouldn't have a case. He ended up pleading guilty in Virginia, where the standards were looser and where they also have the death penalty. Yeah. And so the deal was you can avoid the death penalty if you plead guilty to kidnapping and murder. And so he opted to stay in prison the rest of his life.
as you had said, this was a case that haunted you. Does that feel like justice? Do you feel like justice was done?
More than I ever imagined.
Really?
Because, sure, I mean, back when I covered the story and they found nothing and weeks and months went by, you realize they're never going to we're never going to know, you know, what happened to these girls. So now we do kind of know. There are still many things about the case that we don't. But Lloyd Welsh, without question, kidnapped them from the mall. He was present. There are witnesses that he was present when their bodies were burned. So we know he is the primary culprit. Mm-hmm. But the exact details of what happened, I don't think will ever be known.
Well, in fact, the detectives involved have different theories about whether he was the lone killer or whether it was part of this larger conspiracy.
Right. I mean, I think that is remaining, you know, one of the big questions, because there were so many family members who Lloyd named as perpetrators who were plausible. And given the culture of that family, you could see, you know, that these people may have been involved, but there was no proof of it. And each of the detectives in time has come to their own hypothesis of this is how it happened. It is, frankly, hard to believe that Lloyd could have kidnapped two girls, 10 and 12 years old, and abused them and killed them all by himself and disposed of their bodies. And given that they were the subject of a massive manhunt, it kind of does strain credulity to believe that he managed this all by himself.
Well, let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Mark Bowden. We're talking about his latest book. It's called The Last Stone, about the mysterious kidnapping and murder of two young girls. It happened more than 40 years ago. A convict who is serving time in a Delaware prison pled guilty to two counts of felony murder almost 2 years ago. We're talking about lying and detective work, and we'll be taking a very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with journalist and author Mark Bowden about his new book called The Last Stone. And again, you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. These two girls' parents are still alive. Mm-hmm. They made statements at his when he pled guilty, Lloyd Welch, when he pled guilty. But I kept thinking about them this whole time as I'm reading about what happened to their daughters. I mean, to be perfectly honest with you, just the horrifying way that they died. Mm-hmm. Do we know how they are doing, or even how they are doing with your book?
Well, I do know that they're fine with my book. I wrote to them very early on to tell them what I was doing, and they chose not to be involved. They don't want to be interviewed about this anymore. They've gotten on with their lives, but they communicate to me through the detectives who they know well.
Right.
And you know, the detectives have told me that they appreciate the work that the police department has done. They feel that it deserves recognition, and so that they're glad for that. Yeah. But this all has to be painful for them.
Absolutely. You actually, about a year ago, went down to the prison in Delaware to interview, I guess, to talk to Lloyd Welch.
Right.
What was your interest in seeing him, I guess, personally?
Well, I try to see and get to know everyone I write about, and you know, this book is in many ways about him. Yeah. So I couldn't really write it. I could have, but I didn't want to write it without never having met him. So early on, I wrote him a letter saying, look, I'm writing this story. I want to interview you about it and hear your side. And he wrote back saying that if I put $5,000 in his prison account and met certain other of his demands, like I wasn't allowed to name him in the story or and a bunch of other ridiculous things. And so I just wrote him back and said, you know, I'll talk to you about it. Because I just
didn't
wanted
to say yes or didn't say no.
No, right? I just said, let's discuss. You know, I knew I wasn't going to give him anything, but it would give me a chance to meet him. And I knew, because he loves to talk, you know, once I sat down with him, I could probably ask him the one or two real questions that I had for him, which I was ultimately able to do.
In fact, the question you had for him was, why did you keep talking to the detectives?
Right. And that's, I think, the biggest question, because Lloyd did this to himself. I mean, right from going to the police in 1975, he introduced himself into this case. They never would have known about him if he hadn't done that. And then when they go down 30-some years later and interview him, he talks so much, he eventually talks himself into a murder conviction. Mm-hmm. So why? I mean, at any point, he could have said, I refuse to. Any lawyer would have advised him to shut up. And so I wanted to know. And I asked him.
What did he say? He said,
well, I kind of enjoyed talking to them. And also, he told me he had no choice, that he was forced to talk to them, which I knew was not true. But then he went on and later in our conversation to say how much he enjoyed the conversations getting out of the prison. They brought him fast food, which was, he liked better than the prison commissary. I do think you can't underestimate the attraction to someone who's been locked up for that long, to getting out from behind the prison walls and talking to people who are not fellow inmates and having long conversations. I just think that coupled, he didn't say this, but then it's apparent to me that he needed to talk to them in order to find out what they knew.
Oh, interesting. So do you see him as smart? I mean, is he a smart person?
Yes. Yeah, he is.
Even though he, in a sense, talked himself into prison forever. And we should say he had a long arrest record, prison record, right, even before all this stuff.
Yeah. Like some other people we know, he is a lot of native intelligence. He's deeply ignorant. He's never been educated, and he has very little experience in the real world. And he's arrogant on top of that. He believes he's smarter than everybody. And so I think that's a combination that is very either dangerous, both to himself and ultimately to other people. But he, in his situation with me, making these demands of me that are completely ridiculous. You know, he's a convicted felon serving time in prison. The fact that he can somehow tell me you're not allowed to use my name in a story is just ridiculous. And yet he seemed to believe that he had that sway. So that's just an example of how he has a poor sense of situation. He doesn't really understand the situation he's in. And I think that's evident in his relationship with the detectives as well.
You told me before going on the air that we live in the age of lies, and it's hard not to argue that we don't live in the age of lies. But first of all, why do you think we live in this age of lies? And what does this particular person, Lloyd Welch, what does he tell us about lying?
Well, Lloyd, to me, I got to know him pretty well writing this book, and you know, he has become emblematic of the era, it seems to me, of people who really have no stake or interest in the truth. What they say is calculated to advance themselves, their agenda. They're trying to sell you a product, trying to sell you a candidate. We see this in our political life, where we have a president who makes up things all the time, for whom the truth is purely a public relations device, you know, and anything that exposes a lie is fake and is itself false. So it creates a very slippery environment, certainly for our politics. It's true in our journalism, and it dismays me, having been a journalist my whole life, to see the profession, or what purports to be the profession, turn into propaganda. Hmm. And, you know, where we have whole networks 24/7 that are devoted to selling you a particular point of view or a party or a candidate. I used to teach journalism, and I found that it was hard for my students anymore to know the difference between activism, which is trying to sell something, and journalism, which is trying to tell you something. And I would have to teach them that, you know, you approach things differently as a journalist. You are genuinely interested in knowing what happened and why it happened. And this has been, you know, for me, the purpose of my work my whole life. So it is, as I said, dismaying to see this age that we live in, where everything is for sale and everybody's selling you and pitching you.
Well, and disinformation, whatever you want to call it, lies, disinformation, is very disorienting. I mean, you know, we try on this show to keep up with the news, and I find myself, sometimes I have to start at the beginning just to remind myself about what facts are about a particular case. Even with the Mueller report, it's only a couple of weeks old, and I still have to go back to the beginning to remind myself about what the facts are.
Yeah. And it's never been easy to find the facts, Marty. And the fact is that most people, I think, sensible people understand that they don't know the truth. I think that the internet has given everyone a platform. I think the Bible says that ignorant people aren't interested in knowledge. They're only interested in expressing their opinion. Does that not define, you know, where we are? People spout off.
Where part of the Bible is that from?
It's a psalm.
Oh, it is. Okay.
And I didn't quote it exactly, but that's what it says. And it's true. I think that, you know, I was invited for many years to go on these talk shows and to be a pundit. And early in my career, I did go on those shows. I don't do it anymore, and I haven't for a long time. But one of the things that would happen is that people would start asking you about things that I knew I didn't know enough to have an opinion about. And I would say, I don't know, which are like the three words that you're not allowed to ever say on television. Then people stopped asking me back at that point. But, you know, I don't ever watch any television news anymore, what's called news, because it's punditry. It's people spouting off about something that they have not reported on themselves. Mm-hmm. My own children have come to me and said, where do I go to find information that's true? And I said, well, you have to look at whether, number one, there's any reporting, whether the person telling you this or writing this has actually gone somewhere and interviewed somebody. Somebody talks about the mob or the gangs coming up from South America, crashing our border. And so I look for a reporter who's actually gone down and met the people who are coming up the road from South America and asked them, you know, who are you and why are you coming? That gives me new information. So I think that these are skills that are not intuitive, but we all are having to learn in order to navigate this world of lies.
Well, even going back to your book and going back to Lloyd, you say Lloyd didn't care about the truth.
Right. Not at all. And again, it was completely fungible to him. And what he said was designed for him to get over, you know, to convince somebody of something that frequently was not true. And if he was caught in a lie, I think most of us caught in a lie are embarrassed. And we admit, oh, gosh, you know, I spoke too soon or, you know, I was misinformed. Not Lloyd. You know, you call him on a lie and it's like it's as though he'd never said it. And the president is this way. I mean, if he's proved to be wrong about something, he just claims I never said it. And even if there's recordings of him saying it. So he's not the only one.
No, he's not the only one. But it is interesting, even as a journalist, reporter, as you are, about then how you cover. And maybe these detectives tell us, but this, you know, this took 2 years to get to the bottom of this case, or what appeared to be the bottom of this case, whether reporters really have the kind of skills to really take on a pathological liar.
A lot of them do. I think, you know, there are good ones and there are bad ones. You know, I think your motivation can be very shallow. I just want a story that I can slap up on the internet that'll draw a lot of attention, or I really want to know what happened. And it's harder to get at the truth. And this story illustrates that, particularly when the people you're talking to are trying to mislead you, who don't want you to know the truth.
But as you also say, human motivation is hard to pin down. I mean, people are in certain ways unknowable to some degree, but also that memories differ in significant ways. So even going back to this case and the fact that the detectives had different theories about what may have happened, we're still dealing with memory and human nature.
Right. And what I've learned to do as a reporter is to tell the reader how I know what I know, and they can judge whether that's believable, reliable source or not. Mm-hmm. And I think that I don't believe the truth is ultimately knowable to any of us human beings. All you can do is make an honest effort to understand. That's all you get from me. You know, when I write a story, you're getting my honest understanding of what happened here. And it's well informed if I've done my work. Mm-hmm. And if I'm telling you this is how I know what I know, you can either accept it or reject it on the basis of, you know, where it's coming from and what's there.
You say the best interrogators are connoisseurs of untruth.
Yeah.
So they know they're looking for the truth, but they understand the untruth.
They do. And they also hopefully come to see the motivation behind the lie and work on that. I mean, I find if I'm interviewing someone and let's say they're not necessarily lying to me, but they won't tell me something, I want to know why. You know, are you afraid? if you're afraid, what are you afraid of? Are you afraid of losing your job? Are you afraid of, you know, somebody accusing you of something? And if I can get at the source of the fear, I can very often do something, even if it is offering not to use a person's name or something, to help them get over whatever it is that's keeping them from talking to me. So I think that skill is exactly the same thing that detectives are doing.
Have you ever been a good liar?
No, I'm terrible.
You're not a good liar?
No, in fact, my wife...
Because I'm a pretty good liar.
No,
I'm embarrassed to admit, but
my wife ridicules me about it because, like, she's lectured me for years on learning how to tell the white lie that lubricates social interaction.
Really?
Like,
oh,
no,
you're one of those.
I can't
right.
come to your party because my mother is in the hospital and I have to visit her. But my mother isn't in the hospital. But tell them that she is in the hospital.
You can't do that.
I find it very hard.
Oh, that's so interesting. Again, going back to this story, Lloyd Welch says to Dave Davis, the detective, you're a good cop. You're a cop, but you're a good guy. You have a good heart. And I found that so chilling because here's this murdering, pathological liar complimenting the detective
right.
who's, in a sense, taking him down.
But what a success for Dave.
Well, what exactly? Because, but it still feels...
Because ultimately, Dave's heart in these negotiations was not a good heart. I mean, he was pretending. And he was pretending because he was trying to get Lloyd to admit something that was going to lock him up in prison, if not get him executed. So Dave's intentions, at least where Lloyd was concerned, were not good intentions. And yet he managed to convince Lloyd that they were. So I think that's actually a fairly crowning success for Dave.
To be complimented by, again, you know, pathological... Lying
it means
murderer.
Whatever I'm selling you, buddy, you just bought it.
Yeah. So how is Dave Davis, how is he doing?
He's okay. You know, this case really troubles him. He remains, I think, very frustrated that they didn't get all the answers that they were looking for, that mattered a great deal to them being able to tell the Lyon family, here's exactly what happened, and bring the bodies of their daughters home. They never succeeded in doing that. I think you wallow in the pit for so long, you feel tainted by it. And, you know, we've talked about my publisher has wanted Dave to participate in promotional things where this book is concerned. And I tell him, Dave, don't do anything that you don't feel comfortable doing. And so far he hasn't wanted to.
Yeah. Do you believe in closure?
Yeah, I think so. I think it matters. It certainly, in this case, just speaking for myself, wondering for so long how this could have happened or who would have done something like this. I feel like this story has gone a long way toward answering that. The answers are terrible, but I can understand them. I can understand who Lloyd Welch is, where he came from. As horrible as it is, I can see him doing this.
Well, Mark Bowden, as always, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Marty.
And his new book is called The Last Stone. And he spent some 20 years at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He now writes for The Atlantic and Esquire and is the author now of 13 books, including Black Hawk Down and Hue 1968. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us.